A negative event in our day can often result in a series of negative emotions and behaviours, which in turn trigger stress reactions, and those result in poor physical, mental and emotional health. That need not happen if we know how to prevent the trigger event from cascading into an emotional response. But is that possible, or does it sound too hard? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello, I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Do strangers think of us in the same way as we think of ourselves? Are they more critical of our appearance than we are, or is it the other way around? Here's a BuzzFeed video of an experiment done with a group of strangers. Some of them were asked to stand in front of a mirror and discuss their physical appearance. Meanwhile, there was a secret that they didn't know about. Watch.
I came in not knowing what I was really coming in for.
I was brought into a room that had a big mirror in front of me.
And they asked us questions about first impressions.
I just started talking away about my imperfections and what parts of myself I see in the mirror.
I haven't told this to anyone.
Just really going over how I viewed myself and how I think others view me. I've definitely struggled with weight issues.
I definitely look at people and I'm like, do I look fat today?
Does my hair look all right?
You always want to have better skin, have a better body.
I'm kind of self-conscious of my round face, especially like my cheekbones here.
He's in shape. He has nice cheeks.
He has really nice cheekbones.
I feel like he's the life of the party and I'd gravitate towards him.
I think I have donkey legs.
That's a great body type. I don't know if she realizes how lucky she is.
I never really felt like I was manly.
I definitely think that he's like masculine.
He seems like a cool guy.
I've always been self-conscious of my dimples.
I really like her smile. She has really cute dimples.
She's probably a really fun person.
When I look in the mirror, I'm like, do I need to lose weight?
I think she's in shape. If she's mean to herself, then that's just kind of one of those weird things where everybody's harsher on themselves.
Oh boy, okay.
I think she's pretty. He's got a great beard.
She has a great smile.
He's like really fit.
Definitely wins people over.
I like her hair.
Oh.
He doesn't say a lot, but when he does say something, it means something.
That was so crazy.
What are your first thoughts?
Wow.
I wasn't really expecting that.
So no one heard what was going on?
I feel a lot better now.
It is cool to see somebody else's perspective. The mirror lies, man. I guess, yeah, I don't trust the mirror.
Like, people think completely different than, like, what you might think of yourself.
We all see what's bad about our own body. We don't actually see what's great.
I am stuck in my body till I die. So what good is it gonna do if I'm mean to myself?
You're better than who you think you are, and that you're enough just the way you are. So be kinder to yourself.
Though some people think they're better than they are. Whichever way, listening to others is helpful. We've got part two of our delicious dessert today and some fun with Sean, and of course more from our expert on thinking. But first, the news. In the headlines today, is CBT on par with antidepressants for major depression? Is city transportation too complex for the human mind? And why fidgeting is good for health? Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and antidepressants are equally effective for the treatment of major depression, according to the American College of Physicians. After analysing 43 studies, researchers concluded that CBT and antidepressants had similar response rates and remission rates, though more adverse events were reported by those on antidepressants. They also found 12 studies comparing antidepressants with St. John's wort and found similar response and remission rates, though quality control can be a problem with botanicals. So before you embark on medication for depression, be sure to ask your doctor about the option of CBT. Recent research suggests that transit maps cannot have more than 250 connection points to be easily readable. Most cities with populations over 5 million have multiple transit systems. For example, one trip might entail a walk from home to the bus stop, a bus ride to the subway that then travels to the city with an interchange along the way, followed by a walk, bus or taxi ride to your final destination. Researchers estimate that the human brain can track information for about 4 objects in visual working memory and 8 bits in planning an unfamiliar route, and that 80% of trips planned in large cities exceed that cognitive threshold. So if you feel overwhelmed when traveling in a large city, you might use an app to help you navigate. Fidgeting may reduce the risk of death associated with excessive sitting. Over 12,000 women in the UK Women's Cohort study were followed for 12 years. Those sitting for 7 or more hours a day had a 30% increased risk of death compared to those sitting for less than 5 hours a day. However, women who scored high on fidgeting were 37% less likely to die, even though they sat for prolonged periods of time. So if you spend a lot of your day sitting, be sure that you fidget. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Nedley, internal medicine physician and author of the book Lost Art of Thinking. Let's start by reviewing the ABCs of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes, the A is the activating event, the B is the belief, and the C is the consequence. First there's an emotional consequence, then a behavioral consequence. So in reality, it's our thoughts that cause our emotions and behavior, more so than what actually is happening to us.
Give us some examples. Say road rage. Play that out for us.
Well, with road rage, you have someone cut you off, and then you actually start thinking some bad things about them if you get to the rage point of view. And not only do you think bad things about them, but you also start telling yourself that you can't stand this. And when you start telling yourself that you can't stand something, that's when you start losing your temper and you get out of control emotionally. And in reality, you can stand it. We teach people there's only one thing a human being cannot stand, and that's death. Everything else they actually can stand, but when they tell themselves they can't stand it, that's when the brain starts acting as though it can't stand it, and the emotions go into this fight or flight mode and start getting out of control, start adversely affecting our body organs, and we end up in a heap of trouble that we've actually put on ourselves, but we're blaming the driver that cut us off.
So how might we change our beliefs to not react that way in that same situation?
Well, in that same situation, we can be annoyed over the fact that we got cut off, but then we can remind ourselves, you know what? I might be a few seconds later because this happened, but it's not the end of the world. And I can actually still, make it to my appointment within seconds of if he wouldn't have done this.
Right. So that avoids your blood pressure going up, your pulse going up, the adverse, perhaps the cardiovascular consequences and all of those, and getting in a funk.
You're right. And also maybe getting into a fight that could end your life. These days, you're not sure if you pull up next to the driver and flip him off or whatever, that he might not put a bullet in your head.
And we don't want that. After the break, we're heading into the kitchen for the next stage and a delicious cheesecake. So don't go away, but first this.
Oh, I love the warm embrace of that sunshine. It's so comforting on my face.
Yeah, but you know, it's more than just comforting. Sunshine converts cholesterol to vitamin D in our skin. And vitamin D is important in preventing a number of serious illnesses like cancer and diabetes. In fact, if you have enough vitamin D, then you're 40% less likely to have diabetes.
And vitamin D also boosts our calcium absorption into our system, therefore strengthening our bones so we can resist osteoporosis, bone disease, and fractures as well.
That's true. And dark-skinned people like me, though, are more likely to be vitamin D deficient than fair-skinned people like yourself.
Is that right? So do people like yourself need more sunshine?
Yep. As much as 5 times more.
Wow, aren't you afraid of burning if you get that much?
Well, I'm more concerned that people don't get enough sunshine than getting too much. And besides, us darkies, we don't burn as quickly as you whiteies. But yeah, you shouldn't burn.
Well, I've also heard that vitamin D boosts our immunity.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Our T cells, which are the first line of defense for our immune system, absolutely need vitamin D to function.
And so if we want to resist colds and flus and other diseases, we need to get plenty of sunshine?
Yep, that's right. Doctor's orders.
Well, then I think it's my duty to sit back, relax, and absorb this beautiful sunshine.
I agree.
Thanks, Doc.
Welcome back, and we are on the next stage of our cheesecake. Phil, what are we doing?
This is my favorite part. To me, it's the tasty. It's the filling.
Yum.
And unlike
the
most...
Cheese.
The cheese
and the cake.
But the great thing about this is because a lot of cheesecakes have 4 packages of cream cheese that go into the filling. So we are getting rid
How
of all that.
How do you know that?
I've made one from time to time. But this is so much better because this has tofu. So this is so much better than just putting in a bunch of cream cheese.
Right. And don't tell your guests that it's tofu. Keep them guessing. You might never tell them, but they might never guess that this is tofu. It's really
Absolutely. Good. Absolutely.
So what goes in?
Okay. So we're starting out with 2 tablespoons of pineapple juice, 2 cups of mashed firm tofu, which equals about 1 pound, 2 tablespoons of vanilla, 2/3 cup of honey, 1/4 cup of cashews, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of lemon zest, and 1/2 teaspoon of lemon extract. So it sounds like a lot, but it's so simple because once you measure it out, you're almost there. So what we've done is we've put our cashews and the juice together. We've kind of soaked them a little bit.
Because that will soften up your cashews and make them easier to blend.
Yes.
So that you get a nice smooth texture.
So we're going to put everything in here and blend it up.
And having your cashews in gives it the creaminess. I mean, tofu has that creaminess too. And one thing about which tofu to use, and not everyone around the world will have this kind of tofu, but this is the Morinu silken tofu, which doesn't have that beany taste that the other blocks of tofu can have. So these tofu in a box are the best to use for dessert. I think of them as dessert tofus. I mean, you can use them for other things as well, but they work out perfectly.
I like the idea of a dessert tofu. So I'm just putting everything in and just put a little bit of salt in.
I'll just start zesting this lemon up. And you probably don't want to blend the lemon zest because you want to keep it more whole.
Exactly.
Add it at the end, hey?
That we're going to leave out, but all the rest we're putting in together.
Let's see. And that lemon extract is just going to really make the taste of the zest. Zing!
And I love, just in the whole process, I love the smell. Lemon has such a great smell, especially for the kitchen.
It does. I don't like handling garlic because, you know, your fingers smell for ages, but I love handling lemon because, again, your fingers smell for ages.
So you just want to blend this up, just puree it. And then it's not a bad idea partway through, just kind of pull the lid off and scrape the edges. But you can see that it's working really well. It's gotten very smooth. And you want to make sure you want to get it very smooth. It'll be most like cheesecake if you do that.
If I make it, I'll do this for a special occasion when we're having a crowd. I'll make 2 batches at once, but then you'll have to pulse it to sort of get it to mix properly. But when you've just got 1 batch, it just
it's
blends
very
beautifully.
Easy. Mm. And I think that's it.
Great.
Now this is so easy. If you've ever made a cheesecake, it's such a difficult ordeal. But this is very easy.
Shall I get this in here somehow?
I'll put that down, make it easier for you.
Yeah, the short stuff will struggle with that. There we go.
I'm just going to give that a little bit of a stir. Now, we've made this previously. We haven't baked it. So we're just going to take our filling and put this into it. And then we're going to bake it together. So you don't want to bake the crust beforehand. You want to wait until you have this filling, and then you're going to bake it together on 350 for about 20 minutes.
Super.
And what you want to do is watch it. Make sure you don't burn it. Just kind of get it until it's kind of darkened, kind of like browned and golden brown. Smooth it out, and you have your filling.
Wow, that smells great. You know, I just realized everything in there is cooked, so we could just start now. No, but we won't. We won't.
I like the way you think.
We'll bring you the next part, which is the fruit topping that goes on top, and the next part of this series. Meet Carol. She found going through cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, a painful but healing process. Here's her story.
My name's Carol Catley, and I'm 73 now. I had cognitive behavioural therapy in the millennium year because my husband had died a couple of years before. I think it was hit me particularly badly because we'd been together for so long, and also I had suffered from depression when I was a teenager. One of the things about CBT, when you go through all this, it's a very emotional experience, because when you sort of relive things, it's very, very, very agonizing in many ways. I think that by the time I'd finished the course, I'd done eight or whatever it was, treatments, I was definitely had shaken a lot of things out of myself. And it had given me confidence in actually being able to help myself. You know, I thought I couldn't help myself. The CBT worked for me because I understood what was happening. It was a very clearly defined exercise that were obviously leading somewhere. And the truth is that they worked, you know, the actual system of going through the whole experience as you do with CBT, deliberately and sort of raking everything up. It definitely achieved something. Now, the other thing that the psychiatrist did was to give me a book, which everybody now uses, called Mind Over Mood, where, you have exercises that you can do on your own. I mean, this is just one of many books, but it's a very, very good one for depression. I think CBT is a vital treatment as an alternative to antidepressants. I mean, it is such a different experience. You feel as if you're in control of your own destiny. You're not, you know, it's a sort of sensible, rational thing that you can do to help yourself.
Indeed it is. And in Dr. Nedley's book, Lost Art of Thinking, he outlines 10 cognitive distortions that can get in the way of healthy thinking. So here's Dr. Nedley to explain the all or nothing thinking.
All or nothing means that we see things completely black or white. You know, it's either completely one way or the other. And sometimes that's true, but most of the time it's not true. All or nothing statements can be, she is perfect. You know, if we actually believe that, we're in for some trouble because we're going to find out there are some imperfections that are actually
there.
Yeah,
if we're marrying her because she's perfect.
And of course, it can go the other way as well, where we actually state that because, well, I'll just give you an example of all or nothing thinking of a patient that came into me and said, because I lost the race for Congress, I am a big zero. Does that mean he's a big zero because he lost the race? I could tell by the look on his face he believed what he was saying, but of course it was not true. Because you fail a test doesn't mean you're a big zero. Because you got a divorce doesn't mean you're a big zero. But yet that's where all or nothing thinking can lead to.
Right. And
But are we born with this way of thinking? Like, you know, you see parents and children with this pattern of thinking. Is it part of our personality to a certain extent?
Well, it is. I don't like to think it's part of the personality. Yeah, it may be some things that we've seen modeled in the way of thinking. There may be some genetic tendencies to think, you know, in distorted ways in certain areas.
Or being a perfectionist, that perfectionists live in a black or white
yes,
world.
Yes,
if
that's
right.
If it's
not right, they just don't want to do it.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
I think of some of my nephews and nieces who are like that, but
right.
They're adopted into the family and they still do it,
yeah.
Even though it's not being modeled to them. I mean, yeah, it's
right.
Not being modeled.
Yeah. But no, there are some definite genetic influences. But the nice thing about it is, no matter what, you know, distortion is causing you problems, it can be corrected, and actually a wonderful personality can emerge that is still the basic personality is going to be there, but it's going to be a very balanced personality that is fun to be around, that's attractive, and that is very successful.
So now you've given us an example of someone who turned that all or nothing in on themselves and told themselves they were a big fat zero. That's really going to knock their confidence, their self-esteem.
Absolutely.
But we can do that to other people as well and just destroy relationships that way because we start thinking all or nothing about someone who was a friend or...
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can start thinking all or nothing thoughts about... You know, even our life partner, which can be distorted.
Oh, right. Yeah. Now, is there a place for all or nothing thinking? Are there times in our life where we do need to be that black and white about things?
Well, yes. I mean, for instance, a neuron, one single neuron either fires all the way or not at all. You know, one single muscle fiber either fires all the way or not at all. But there's no bicep muscle that fires all of the bicep fibers 100% of the time. You know, the weightlifters, the best they can do is about 80%. If they could do 100%, they'd win the event.
Wow. And are there circumstances in our lives or belief systems that we need to be all or nothing thinking about? That we need to say that is truth or that is not?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. So we do need to identify things as being either truthful or not. And but that's, you know, that's why all or nothing thinking has to be looked at to see whether it's distorted or not. Mm-hmm. Most of the time it is going to be distorted, but occasionally it is either one way or the other.
So how does someone who has all or nothing thinking set about changing that way?
Well, they have to be intentional and forceful to look for a different way of analyzing it, and so that's where they have to teach themselves, particularly when their emotions start getting out of control. That's when they have to be aware and then start analyzing their thoughts. So the first thing we do with individuals is we have them listen to their thoughts. The second thing we do with them is look for distortions in those thoughts once they learn the 10 different ways of distorted thinking, of which we've covered one. And then they need to reconstruct their thinking into what is true and accurate thoughts, and then they need to practice. Mm. And so those are the four steps.
Okay. That's quite a process. Now, you also talk in your book about overgeneralization.
Yes.
What does an overgeneralizer look like?
Well, an overgeneralizer, there's several different categories of overgeneralizers, but first a little bit about what overgeneralization is. Overgeneralization is using limited factual evidence to believe something that actually is not true. And so you're just using limited factual evidence, and then you develop this belief that simply is not true. And so it can be, you know, holding the hypothesis as a fact rather than a hypothesis, or generalizing from too few instances.
Give us an example of what that might be.
Well, an example can be the one that I like to share is of my suite mate when I was in my pre-med college days. And he was a pretty intelligent young boy, good looking, but pretty shy, And he had his eye on a girl for about 6 months before he mustered up enough courage to ask her out. And the rest of us were dating other girls, and so he looked up to us as someone that could be able to help him be able to catch this girl. And so we gave him some ideas, and he thought, you know, he'd follow those ideas, and he came back to the dorm shaking his head and looked like he was about ready to cry and, you know, just had this downcast look. And I said, Glenn, what happened? And he said, Neil, I'm destined to be lonely and miserable the rest of my life.
Oh, wow.
And I said, what did she say? She said she had another event and couldn't go. And so you conclude that you're going to be lonely and miserable the rest of your life? And he said, well, I just thought about if she just thought half as much about me as I think about her, she would have canceled that event and gone with me. So I'm destined to be lonely and miserable the rest of my life. Well, he had overgeneralized a couple ways.
Right.
First way he overgeneralized is because she turned him down once, she was always going to turn him down. He didn't really know that to be true, but he certainly assumed it. Mm. And the second overgeneralization he made was that 100% of eligible women had identical taste to hers, and thus he would be endlessly rejected the rest of his life. So one of the characteristics of overgeneralizers, some of them, is they have a fear of rejection, a fear of trying new things. And it's a distorted thought they need to get over with to get over the lack of function that that way of thinking can cause.
We're about to take a break, but before that, here's a character in the Bible with some distorted thoughts that got him in trouble, way over his head. Most of us know the story of Jonah, who was sent by God to warn the inhabitants of Nineveh that because of their wickedness, they would be overthrown in 40 days. But Jonah didn't want to go, and he had the problem of all or nothing thinking. So instead of just staying home, he boarded a ship and sailed in the opposite direction. Big mistake. A huge storm arose, threatening to sink the ship, and instead of praying and repenting, he told the crew to throw him overboard, which they did. Swallowed by a huge fish, he spent 3 days inside of that fish, which in his black and white world he described as being forever. Finally, he repented and was thrown up on shore. Then God again invited him to go on the Nineveh mission, and this time he went. Nineveh was a huge city, but all or nothing Jonah did a great job, and soon the whole city was fasting, praying, and repenting. Fast forward 40 days, and we find Jonah sitting outside the city waiting for the overthrow, but it doesn't come. He was mad at God. He did some overgeneralizing, mind reading, and discounting of the positives. I knew you would do this, he said. You are so gracious and merciful, so slow to anger, so full of love and kindness. That's why I ran away the first time. I knew it would be this way. Now I am so embarrassed that what I told them didn't come to pass. It's better for me to die than to live. Please just take my life. So God asked him if it was right for him to be angry, and Jonah didn't reply, so God grew a vine to shade him from the blazing hot sun, which made Jonah happy. Now he wanted to live. Then a caterpillar came along and killed the vine, which made Jonah angry, and again he asked to die. So God asked him, is it right for you to be upset about the plant? Yes, because the poor plant died. So you had pity for the plant, but you couldn't understand my pity for the 120,000 inhabitants of Nineveh and all the animals? We're not told if Jonah ever corrected his distorted thinking because the story ends there. We are simply left to ask, is our all or nothing thinking affecting the way we feel, the way we behave, and the way we treat people? We're back and it's time to get moving because Sean's here. Hey. Hi, Sean.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. It's that time again. What are we going to do?
Okay, so I get a lot of questions from people who, you know, bump into me and they say, how do I lose weight? I'm like, you know, you got to work for it.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to show you a really quick way of throwing some high intensity training into just a normal routine, which is great for the body, during the workout and post-workout. That's the key, to work out to that level where you're burning calories up to 24 hours post-workout.
Right.
Okay, so if you're at the gym, jump on the treadmill, do some jumping jacks if you choose. If you're at the park, you know, get warmed up. But again, getting the body ready. I'm going to show you two ways of doing mountain climbers, okay? One is we're going to go down to the ground, keep your hands right here, and we're going to start with the regular traditional mountain climber. All right, core tight. And before you start, this is the neutral position right here. Your hips are not high. Can you show me how the hips will look high? We don't want it right there. Down, right there, and then begin. Go ahead, boom. So you keep going for about 30 seconds. Okay, make sure you are breathing. The heart rate is gonna start to go up. If you hold your breath, it goes up even higher, okay? Now, if you were to get a little, if this is the first time you're doing this, please take your time, okay? You're in a position where you're working your core, you're working your cardiovascular system, but you don't wanna, you know, overexert yourself. And now the crossbody, go right into it where you're taking that right knee and going toward, yes, there you go. This is a little bit more challenging, and this is the upgrade to the mountain climber. So give me about five more. Five, four, three, two, and one. And what I want you to do is, now that your heart rate is up, now we're gonna go into the more strength building exercise, the plank, okay?
All right.
So now we're building core strength, all right? So here, hands are relaxed. Your spine is neutral. Look down to about right here. The spine is neutral. And if I were to push you, your body would be nice and rigid, okay? This is what you want. This is the plank. It is a great way to burn calories. Are you feeling the challenge? The
burn? I am.
You feeling the burn?
I'm feeling the burn.
Already?
After all those mountain climbs.
Okay, there you go. So here it is. We're gonna
continue. Was the 13th take, remember?
That was. So here we go. And then how do you upgrade this? You turn it right to the side. Put your hand right here. And even if, actually go on your leg like this, right? Now what you could do is just go up on one leg. Mm-hmm. Right? Keep it there. Perfect. And keep the core tight. Now put that hand up just a little bit, and there you go. Now you went from a mountain climber where you increased the heart rate, the plank where you built strength, and here is a little bit more of a challenging plank position,
right,
which again will help build core strength.
Because you got to keep balance.
You got to keep balance. Try the other side real quick. See how that goes.
I'm going to turn my back.
All right. You can do it. Give me five, four, three. Great plank, two, and one. Good job. Again, you want to challenge yourself. You want to be able to, you know, bring up that heart rate. And think about post-workout. You know, how is your body going to adapt? If you're still sweating after you work out, great job. You
right. Know,
still burning calories.
And these big muscles,
yes,
you're just going to burn them that much faster.
Yes, total body exercise is a great way to maximize your time, you know, 10, 15 minutes, and you could reap the benefits.
Now, how do we stretch those?
All right,
muscles?
Let's go. So while we're here, let's stretch the calf. Feet down. Right there. And then what I want you to do is walk your feet to your hands. Come up nice and slow. Open and close. Take a nice deep breath. Finish off your workout. Big circle. And guess what? You are done. Good job.
Don't fall asleep. There's still more to watch. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Is a tomato a vegetable or a fruit? Well, when it comes to preventing ovarian cancer, tomatoes might be the queen of fruit. Women who eat tomatoes more than 5 times per week have a significantly lower risk of ovarian cancer than women who occasionally or never eat them. Women who regularly consumed fruit also had a lower risk, according to the Adventist Health Study. Salsa, anyone? Eating tomatoes at least 5 times a week is another ageless advantage.
Now for the questions I've received from you via Facebook, email, text and phone. Linda asks, I've been told to drink gelatin to improve my nails, my hair, digestion and joints, but I'm vegetarian and the package says bovine. What do I do or what can I take if I should not drink gelatin? Well, since gelatin comes from the ground hooves of cows, in your case, but often pigs, and you're vegetarian, there's a clear mismatch. If you eat 1 cup of green leafy vegetables every day, along with lots of legumes and whole grains, you should get plenty of minerals. And if you're still concerned, you might consider taking a good multivitamin, multi-mineral supplement, you know, a good quality one, just check out the producer, and take that for about 3 to 6 months. Someone else texted, how can I lose weight and have an athletic and healthy body? Don't we all want that? Well, Rome wasn't built in a day, and you didn't gain weight overnight either. So just be patient. Now ask yourself, what's motivating you to make these changes? So figure out what your motivation is and then set some goals. How much would you like to weigh? How much does that mean you need to lose? And realistically, how long will it take to lose that much weight? Then make some daily goals. How much time are you willing to set aside for exercise? The daily recommendation is 22 minutes, but nobody's going to lose weight on 22 minutes. You actually need about 60 minutes a day to lose weight. Now, before you despair, you don't have to do it all at once. You can split that into 10-minute epochs all through the day and just squeeze that into the corners of your day, or you can do it all at once. You could split into two 30 minutes, one in the morning, one in the evening. Now, remember, though, that we eat more calories than we burn with exercise. So for the next week, just watch what you're eating. Just observe it and then decide, what are you willing to give up? Are you eating a lot of fat? That has a lot of calories, so maybe you can slide that off the plate. Then set some dietary goals. Maybe eat a big green salad at the start of your lunch, at the start of your dinner, and lots of fruit for breakfast. Remember, vegetarians weigh less, and total vegetarians who are completely plant-based weigh even less than them. So they also have fewer chronic diseases. There are huge benefits to that kind of eating plan. So there are some thoughts for you. Someone else texted, is it okay for me to drink fruit juice daily, or will the acidity of the juice damage my stomach? Well, fruit juice is a highly processed food. All the fiber's been taken out, and really it shouldn't be consumed on a daily basis. It's not about the acidity. Your stomach acid is a lot more acid than the fruit juice. It's about the calories, the lack of fiber, and the sugar, and the effect that all of that will have on your metabolism. Thanks for those questions. I love hearing from you, so keep sending them. Now let's go shopping. Pears are classified based on their origin as Asian or European pears. Asian varieties are crispy and firm. Their consistency doesn't change after harvesting or storage, so they're ready to eat. Pears are a great source of fiber, each containing over 5 grams. Regular consumption of pears may provide protection against colon cancer. They're a good source of minerals like copper, iron, potassium, manganese, and magnesium, and also B vitamins. High in antioxidants, they're the least allergenic of all fruits. They've also been used in traditional medicines to treat colitis, gallbladder disorders, arthritis, and gout because of their mild anti-inflammatory properties. Apart from eating them raw, a great way to eat pears is to blend them with a small handful of raw cashews and turn them into pear cream. Bon appetit. Before the break, Dr. Nedley was telling us about his college roommate who had had his eye on a girl for about 6 months. When he finally mustered up enough courage to ask her out, she declined and said she had another event. He therefore concluded that he was destined to be lonely and miserable the rest of his life. I asked Dr. Nedley if it's possible to view failure like that in a healthy way.
The healthy way to see failure is to look for the reasons why there's failure, or at least you feel there's failure, and to actually not disqualify the positive. It actually gets into another cognitive distortion where those who actually fail and continue to fail actually disqualify the positive, meaning that they actually think it's going to be an unending series of events that continue to fail. What we tell people is analyze what went wrong, correct what went wrong, and you can turn defeat into victory. And that is a very successful thing to do. Mm-hmm. All of us are going to have failures. We live in an imperfect world, and we're also imperfect individuals, and so we're going to have failures. But we need to analyze what went wrong, correct it, particularly the thinking behind it, and then we can move on.
And it can be painful to go back and analyze a failure.
It can be.
So the temptation is to just stuff it away and not think about it.
Exactly.
But you're saying it's really important at that time to snatch triumph from the jaws of defeat by actually sitting and analyzing that situation and saying, how could it be different and why did it happen?
Exactly. I teach people that to make a mistake is one thing, but to not correct it is making another mistake. And that another mistake is even worse than the first mistake, because you're doomed to repeat failure if you don't correct your mistakes.
Right. So can truth lie within a generalization? Can there be truth in there?
Oh, yes. There's always some truth in an overgeneralization. You know, there's some facts that are there. And so it's not that the whole thing is a lie. It's just that we are, there's actually some factual evidence for us to develop this belief that actually isn't quite true.
Right.
Elijah did that, you know. He said, I'm the only one that has not bowed the knee to Baal. What he should have said is, I'm the only one I know of.
I'm the only one in this wild desert.
But he just knew he was the only one. And that caused him significant depression, and the Lord had to tell him that he was off by a factor of 7,000. So he was off quite a bit. But I mean, he was one though, right?
So that was the truth in there.
That's right.
He was one,
and there wasn't a lot. I mean, when you take a look at the whole nation of millions of people, 7,000 isn't a lot, but 7,000 is still a pretty significant number.
And that's going to be important for us to remember in times that we're living in right now, isn't it?
That's right,
Now, another distortion that you talk about is the unhealthy mental filter. Explain what a mental filter is.
Well, yes, a mental filter is where we're looking at just one side of the equation, and we're actually... you know, it's darkening. How I like to describe it is, it's like, you know, a blot of ink that gets into a beaker of water, and then it just clouds, and, you know, the entire thing.
Oh, good example.
And
okay.
And so that's what a mental filter is. And you know, an example of that would be a guy who came to our program recently and told me that nothing good was going on in his life, and I said, "What's going on?" And he says, "Well, my roof is leaking, bills are piling up, my boss yells at me, my wife continually nags, and I'm so bad off that I had to take this program off on credit card, so I'm in debt." And so nothing was going right in his life. But as I talked to him further, I recognized that, you know, he was still able to sleep well, he was still able to feed himself, he was still able to walk. Even though his wife was nagging, she was a beautiful woman and had some positive characteristics, but yet he was only looking at one side of the equation.
So he was
instead
focused
of the other side.
Okay.
And that's what a mental filter is. We look at only one side of the equation, and we don't balance it out that there are many positives as well.
So how can we combat an unhealthy mental filter? Even take that example. How did you work with him to help him to see the other side? How could he do it on his own?
Yeah, well, he wasn't able to do it on his own before he came to the program.
Right.
But actually, in dialoguing with him and finding these things out, he wasn't going to tell me that at the time because he wanted me to see why everything was so negative.
Right.
But this is why it's good for people to actually come to our program and live with us, because then we start hearing some things and can help them to actually see a little bit of the other side.
So you just start to make just simple inquiry about, is there another side?
That's right.
And so if we're living with someone who does this on a regular basis, we could perhaps gently challenge their thinking and ask them, share more.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's what you're doing with people, but in a very directed way.
That's right.
Because you can identify these filters.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we can't be happy all the time. There's always positives and negatives. So how do we get that balance?
Well, that's how we get it, actually, is by correct thinking. Now, I'm not into the mode where you have to be happy and, you know, thrilled and have a smile on your face all the time. There can be a problem with being too optimistic, and that is when reality continues to set in. But feeling calm is good. Actually, studies show that as far as academically, you'll achieve much better when you're calm as far as memorizing something than when you're happy. And so there are advantages of being calm over being happy sometimes. Now, if you're happy, your creativity goes up. But what we're trying to avoid is the negative emotions that can really get into the way of success. And so we're looking for happiness and calm or a continuum there, but not into this depression and sadness and severe anxiety.
And we have a beautiful example of someone who seems to have achieved that balance right after the break. And we're back. Just a few months before, Mama Hill had faced life-threatening surgery that left her alive but paralyzed. She learned to walk again with a walker. And here, after participating in Soul Pancake's Science of Happiness experiment, she gets the results of her happiness score. Let's see if they can make her any happier.
Let me tell you a little bit about what's going on.
Okay.
These surveys that we gave you, they're designed to measure basically how happy you are. You scored a perfect score. Higher than anybody that we've given this test to since we've been doing this. It's really quite remarkable.
Good.
I think we're all anxious to know, why do you think that is?
Well, I'll give you a very brief little summary of what I do every morning when I wake up. I wake up and I say, this day I choose to be happy, well, and complete. First, I thank God for letting me get up. Then I thank God for the fact that I have running water in a toilet. I have soap. I have toothpaste. There are people in the world who don't have any of those things. And for food. Because sometimes we get them, well, I don't think I can make it today. I don't think I'm going to. But we have to realize that we are truly blessed. Then I thank God for peace in my house. I have a peaceful house. And I meditate. And then after I meditate and have my prayer, I just say, okay, God, how may I serve you today, and who can I help today? And finally, I watch cartoons. And when I watch the cartoons, I wait for the answers I just ask. And that's a very happy, beautiful day for me, because I don't have any, cartoons never have a problem. There's always an end to it, right? Something good happens at the end, and I have several cartoons that I watch until my day begins. And so therefore, I don't have an attitude. I'm glad to be here.
I think you just told us in 2 minutes more than any of the studies we've looked over have. So I'd really like to thank you for coming in today and just generally doing fantastic work for helping out the children that you do and for having a fantastic attitude. Thank you so much for coming in, Mama Hill.
It's my pleasure. You should watch cartoons.
I do.
Yeah, oh, good.
What's your favorite?
Oh, my favorite is Clifford the Red Dog.
Clifford the Big Red Dog, Adventure Time for me. You should check it out. It's great.
And Mama Hill is on to something there. Watching something that makes us laugh, relaxes us, it induces our creative juices, and conveys a sense of well-being emotionally and physically. However, unless we think correctly, the rest of our day, the warm fuzzies won't last. And one area that we get into trouble with is thinking that we can tell what another person is thinking. I asked Dr. Nedley how accurate we really can be.
Actually, highly inaccurate.
Is that right?
Yes. We're actually, if we know the person real well and we understand the situation and we can look at their face, we're about 80% accurate. But that's about as high as you can get.
Wow.
As far as really doing the mind reading. And so when we assume we know what someone else is thinking, it can really cause some relationship problems. And so, but interestingly, human beings have a tendency to actually mind read people they don't know even more so than the ones they know. And of course, that's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah.
And studies show you're only about 20 to 25% accurate in those that you don't know very well. And so we may assume that they're thinking this about us and that's why they're doing that, and we may be way wrong.
Right. So there's some real danger there, but
but that's like putting words in people's mouths and finishing sentences for other people.
Yeah.
Give us another example of how this can get us in trouble.
Well, I mean, it got Abraham in trouble when he was mind reading the king, even ahead of time, of what he would do when he saw Sarah and that he'd be a dead man.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, he was right that the king would think Sarah was beautiful. So, you know, he was right about the beauty of his own wife.
Right, but he was very wrong about what the king would do about it.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And when the king realized that he had been mind-read that way, he was angry at Abraham. And in fact, had it not been for the Lord's intervention, he might have ended Abraham's life for thinking that poorly about the king's morals.
Right. And when he found out that Sarah was married, he sent her home.
He sent her home. Yeah. And then he said, get out of my country.
Yeah. Which wasn't as bad as dying.
That's right. Yeah.
What about catastrophizing? That's always a tough word.
Yes.
But tell us about that. People that do that?
Yeah, we think the worst is going to happen. That's actually categorized under another cognitive distortion called fortune teller error.
Okay.
And so we have a some people have a tendency to think the worst is going to happen. And so these are individuals that, you know, they'll buy a flight and or a ticket on a flight and then they'll cancel it, you know, that day because they just have this feeling that, you know, the plane's going to go down. And crash.
And it doesn't. They
that's
that
right.
Feeling.
Yeah.
So they, to them, it's true. It's real. And
yeah.
So, how do you combat that?
Well, by again teaching them correct thinking. Part of it, people that catastrophize also can get into what's called magical worry. Where they think they have to worry about something, otherwise it might happen. And so they're always, you know, for instance, if they are traveling, I must worry that this plane is going to go down because if I don't, it will go down.
So they worry.
And of course that isn't true at all. And then they'll assume even if, you know, if I do the right thing at work, I'm going to lose my job. That's catastrophizing. And in reality, if they did the right thing, they might be actually more well thought of by their boss and more positive things might actually occur. But they're thinking, nope, my boss is going to think this. So first there's mind reading and then there's catastrophizing and fortune teller error. Now, it is true. They might lose their job. They might know their boss that well. But we also teach people it's best to do the right thing and leave the consequences with God. Because even if you do lose your job in that situation, you're going to get a better job.
Mm. Wow. That's really living under a cloud,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, explain personalization. That's another distortion.
Yes. Personalization is where you something bad happens and then you blame yourself entirely for it. For instance, the sixth grader that comes home with D's and F's on the report card, and the mother looks at that and breaks down and says, I am an absolute failure as a parent. Now, what she's not admitting to is that sixth grader has a lot of responsibility as well, and it's not just her. That sixth grader has something to do with it.
just a little.
And it may be true that she can learn some better parenting techniques or better ways to help motivate her child, or maybe go to one of our emotional intelligence seminars on how to instill emotional intelligence and motivation in kids. But to blame herself entirely for what happened is personalization. It's going to end up defeating her.
Mm. And that must, I've actually seen this even in, you know, brand new mothers. Their baby cries and they blame themselves. And
yeah,
that can be very destructive at a time when you're at risk of postnatal depression, for example.
Yes, that's right.
And, so now that you talk about it, I recognize it in the patients that I've seen. And it's very hard to deal with that, I mean, to help them to see it differently.
Yeah.
Is there a particular technique for personalization? Or is it just all the same thing again?
Well, the technique that we utilize is to help them realize that there is shared responsibility here and they can't take all of the blame themselves. And so just asking them questions. So you're the only cause of this? You know, do you think there's any other causes? Do you think those causes might even be more important than the cause that you're blaming yourself for? So that they can still learn from what they, you know, can do better, but they don't just blame every bad outcome in regards to themselves. And, you know, even when we go through terrible things like the death of a family member, it can get severe where that person blames themselves entirely for the death of their loved one. And that's inappropriate guilt.
To improve our chance of success in life, we need to optimize our emotional intelligence quotient so that we don't react emotionally to everything that happens to us. And for that to happen, distorted thinking needs to be corrected. All or nothing thinking makes your world look black and white. Overgeneralizing is using limited factual evidence to believe something that's not true. And unhealthy mental filters can enable us to look at life in a very lopsided and rather black way. Don't fall into the trap of thinking you know what that other person is thinking, or of catastrophizing or personalizing everything as if everything was your fault. There are more ways we can have distorted thinking, but that's for the next part in this series. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you then.